well, let's just build it and do it. And if we fail along the way, if we crash a rocket, if we try to land empty boosters and a few of them crash, that's part of engineering. That's part of the, that's part of what we do. We build things, we break them, we fix them, we make them better.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, Executive Editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and joining me in the studio is Foreign Policy's diplomatic reporter, Emily Tamkin, and on the phone is Joe Pappalardo. Emily is a diplomatic reporter here. Her recent article on billionaires in space and what it means for international cooperation appears this week in Foreign Policy. Joe's an aerospace author and journalist based in Dallas and a contributing editor for Popular Mechanics. His work has also appeared in Smithsonian Air and Space, Esquire.com. Time, and many other publications. ER listeners, we love hearing from you. You have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. We wanted to talk today about the future of space, not a typical question for Foreign Policy. Joe's recent book, Spaceport Earth, tackles the ever-changing 21st century space industry and what privately funded projects like Elon Musk's SpaceX mean for the future of space travel, specifically for spaceports. At the forefront is the reinvigorated desire to search the final frontier, our industrial titans, engineers, billionaires, airmen, and public officials. So as I mentioned, space travel isn't something we normally talk about at Foreign Policy, but last month, the first space nation left the International Space Station. Asgardia 1, did I pronounce that right, Emily?
Asgardia 1, that's right.
Is actually a satellite launched into space by an Azeri Russian billionaire. The satellite contains personal data from some of the nation's 300,000 citizens. Asgardia, as yet unrecognized by the United Nations, and its citizens are people who filled out an application form. Is it free, Emily?
I actually don't know. I think you probably have to pay a fee to be a citizen of Asgardia 1.
Fascinating. So we'll get back to Asgardia 1 in a second, but let me first turn to Joe. What, you know, in terms of what motivated you to write this book? I mean, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about sort of the privatization in space, but you took almost sort of a geographic approach to it.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. I definitely appreciate it. But the impetus for the book was sort of my own evolution on how I was thinking about space flight. I mean, when I started in the business, it was long enough ago that there's been a lot of, you know, seismic changes that young aerospace reporter wouldn't believe is even possible. And my sort of skepticism of what is achievable slowly eroded, and I kind of wanted to share that experience. I mean, watching the final space shuttle launch is sort of where the book begins, and it ends with private companies launching to the International Space Station, and I would have never bet that could have happened. And to be able to watch it from the staff of Popular Mechanics and then covering it after, I kind of wanted to share that experience and just give a closer view of what happened to spaceflight between the shuttle launching and these private space companies coming up and how it's shaping not only the United States, but what it's doing internationally as well.
Well, let's back up for a second. I think you and I are of the generation where sort of the seminal event for space travel certainly wasn't the landing on the moon. It was the explosion of the space of the Challenger space shuttle. And for us, I mean, I think growing up, what we saw was sort of, you know, either launches that weren't doing that much in terms of, you know, space exploration or disasters like Challenger, which really, I think, was disillusioning in some respects. And you talk about this in your book. Did that sort of color your approach, you think, into thinking about where space exploration should be going?
Definitely. I mean, we didn't have a triumph, like you're saying. We didn't have a big mission. We didn't have a destination. I mean, I love and appreciate the International Space Station for what it is. I think it's a wonder of the world, but it's not that exciting. Some of the research is exciting, but it's not landing on the moon, and it's not, you know, an epic quest. It's a research station, and it's scientific, and it's steady, and it's expensive, and it's wrapped up in diplomacy, and it's not the derring do. It's not the, you know, Rick Ransom, you know, blazing to the universe, and you know, and it's not very personalized either. So I think what Elon Musk did to draw us back into the billionaires, and what people like me and resisted initially was, I'm making bold statements. I'm going to back it up. You know, I'm going to drive the price point of space launch down, and I'm going to change the way that everybody, the government and the private sector, launches rockets. And that's going to open up spaceflight. And you got to call BS on that, because we've heard stuff like that. I mean, we had Richard Branson, you know, out in New Mexico, building a spaceport and launching nothing year after year. So, I mean, we were, I thought, rightfully on guard against that kind of thing and skeptical. And it's not like when you're riding around with United Launch Alliance or anybody else that they were saying good things about SpaceX. There was very smart engineers pointing out some of the things that could go wrong. But his embrace of risk, which is either foolhardy or genius, depending on what happens on the pad, made things happen and really changed the dynamic. And he's winning government launches, winning commercial launches. We didn't have any commercial launches until SpaceX came around, where it was only government launch out of the United States. His company single-handedly changed that, and now others are following in his wake. So, and I've actually told this, but not to be a name-dropping asshole, but I actually mentioned this to him once at a Popper Mechanics thing. I said, you know, I never believed you could do it, but I'm sort of eating crow, and I just want to tell you, you know.
And what did he say? What did he say back?
He said thanks.
That sounds
And then he was with Tallulah Riley at the time, the actress, and she said, yeah, a lot of people don't come out and say stuff like that, even though a lot of people probably think it. So, you know, he appreciates it. And I stood and looked at him and said, I don't think he appreciates it. I think he's barely registering I'm here. But it was a big moment for me and a completely, you know, unimportant moment for him. But it was a chance for me to just say, hey, listen, you know, we're going to give him our breakthrough award that the magazine bestows every year. And I lobbied against him and I held off for a year until he launched the space station. And so it was sort of in that context it made sense to hold off and say, prove it. Prove what you're doing. And sure enough, the guy's done it.
And what did Elon Musk do right that Richard Branson wasn't able? I mean, why was Elon Musk able to move forward where perhaps Richard Branson didn't?
Customer base. I mean, Branson was building a play toy for rich people and convinced a poor county to help fund it, or two poor counties to help fund it, and then didn't follow on an engineering timeline that was unreasonable. Several big things wrapped up in there compared to Elon Musk, who saw a niche in the market, several markets, commercial launch and government launch, saw a way to help fund it by getting NASA grants, you know, delivering for them and proving it in a real world scenario. It's a different kind of an approach, and it could have failed miserably, but his embrace, those are some of the business risk as well as the engineering risk that he embraced that traditional spaceflight people would recoil from. I mean, the payload is worth a lot more than the rocket, even if it's not people. The word risk is a four-letter word. It's the worst thing you can say in a room to someone who owns a satellite that's going to generate billions of dollars in orbit. So, and it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars on the ground. So he's, you know, talking about, hey, lighten up and accept a little bit more risk is not something you hear in the industry. And he brought that to the table and somehow made it stick, and his rockets fly and his payloads get to where they're going, well, most of the time.
So a couple questions. One, what do you make of, because Richard Branson has been quite critical of Elon Musk and sort of said, you know, he's so obsessed with Mars, whereas I'm more concerned with helping humanity. So one, what do you think of that? But then two, since, you know, you keep coming back to this idea of risk, now that we've sort of seen that he has risen to the challenge, like the first set of challenges, do you think that now that he's shown he can do it, that there are new risks that need to be? And if so, what are they?
The risk that, and it ties in Branson and Musk, is the risk of overreach. Mm-hmm. What is truly achievable and what's achievable on your own, what's achievable outside of government regulation or interference or oversight, is where he's going to hit a ceiling sooner or later. It's funny that Branson criticizes Musk when his business model is sliding more towards launches and air launches of satellites, mm-hmm. and on-demand launches, rather than launching rich people into suborbital space. And I mean, that's that market it was proven out by Elon Musk. So he may have a point where he, you know, and the news recently where Elon Musk is bagging on public transport. It's like, oh yeah, well, a rich guy doesn't like to ride in a bus. Go figure. But he's, you know, he seems like a dreamer, and he seems like someone who dreams about Mars and maybe doesn't care so much about Earth. That fits a sci-fi mold where a lot of people have an affinity for that. I mean, you know, the people who are environmentalists from Mars and say, well, maybe we shouldn't build anything there to keep the environment pristine, is like anathema to explorer types who just want to put their roots down and build a windmill and a tunnel and live there. So they're diametrically opposing views in a lot of ways. And it's easy to see Elon as a distant egomaniac, because he is an distant egomaniac. I mean, it's, you know, there it is. But for Branson to level that at him, it's kind of amusing. I mean, this is the man who put his own face on ice cubes of the airline room. So, that's billionaire stuff.
Classic billionaire stuff, you know? Yeah, same. But a question on the environmental point. So someone I spoke to in reporting this piece said that a difference that he sees from, I think it was the 70s, is that back then, people who were really motivated to go to space and settle on space were much more environmentally conscious, and it was about sort of, you know, preserving the Earth and making this new pristine environment, and that he's not seeing that with the current generation of spaceheads. Do you see the current crop of billionaires as, how can I put this, as an extension of the last generation of space nuts, or are they something different than what you had in the 70s or the 60s?
Well, it's a really good question.
And thanks, Joe.
which is, you know, the way I can buy time to get a really good answer to it, which is a little elusive. I think they are the heir to it. I think I recently had a sit down with Tom Stafford, who's an astronaut, and who bitterly lamented what he said was a lot, you know, the lost time, what we should have done, where we should be. You know, it's one thing in media when you're doing science journalism, you say, oh, they just discovered something, they just did something, they just landed somewhere. I mean, we're so conditioned to think, well, we've already seen that. I've seen Europa Report. Why do we need to drill through the ice? You know, flying cars. Who cares? Of course, we've been watching flying cars in cinemas since the Jetsons. Big deal. And all the engineering triumphs that go behind it are left by the wayside. So I think that the bitterness of that generation, and to a lesser extent, that I feel about, oh, we're not going fast enough, we're not going far enough, we're not exploring enough, we've lost the edge, all that kind of talk. And then it's doubled down recently with a lot of, you know, oh, space military edge is now we're losing that. And that's a big meme going on. So the idea that we've fallen behind and this is our national right is ingrained in the Apollo program. I mean, that became national prestige and space became one and the same. They always really were, but that space race really put a fine point on it. And, you know, and then to see the shuttle explode as the counter to that, it's just a large, you know, pickup truck that goes back and forth to space and doesn't really even go very far. And it was still sort of a historic failure in terms of, it was a historic disappointment, I should say, not a failure. It was supposed to do a lot more. It was supposed to open up space, and it didn't. That's what we get, the steady diet of it could have been, it didn't. It was mismanaged. It was dangerous. It was risk-averse but still deadly, you know, all these sort of, all this negativity. And now you've got the antidote, which is, well, let's just build it and do it. And if we fail along the way, if we crash a rocket, if we try to land empty boosters and a few of them crash, that's part of engineering. That's part of what we do. We build things, we break them, we fix them, we make them better. And that ethos, that's hard to deny. Does that not square with environmentalism and being sort of a stewards of the Earth? A lot of them claim it's the thing that inspires people to protect the planet, because you go out into space and you look down and you see the frail little blue marble and everything. Whenever I hear that, I start to cringe, because it sounds like a line. It doesn't sound like what they're doing. You know, like, it doesn't mesh with the goals of the company. So, so it's a nice thought. Astronauts have that thought. It's a kumbaya thought, but it's not really what the business model speaks to.
Yes, but speaking of kumbaya and also national edge, which you did, so something that I have been bumping up against in thinking about this is whether the introduction of, or the, not just introduction, but the involvement of very wealthy private citizens in the space race is good or bad for national cooperation. And people I've spoken to have been very split, right? Some say, well, okay, so the US and Russia have like this one last arena where they can cooperate. And if you introduce private money, what happens to government contact? Whereas others say, okay, but you have citizens from all these countries who are going to make governments work together. And, you know, I go around and I talk about space and it just makes people's walls drop and borders fall. And by the way, we're speaking about something that's literally outside of national boundaries. So which side if either, do you fall on?
It's the refuge of many scoundrels and scoundrel programs, probably, to say, well, this is the thing that will bring us together. Right now, the thing that's driving, you know, the kumbaya apart and is ruining the song is nation-to-nation politics. I mean, at the end of the Cold War, it was the signal of the smartest thing you can do is get the Russians to build rocket engines for us. And it was hailed as this wonderful thing, like the Cold War is done. We're heading towards Star Trek. It's the United Federation of Planets. No one cares once you're off the planet. And when the relationship with Russia soured, and, you know, invasions and scandals and everything else, all of a sudden we're reliant on rocket engines from them, and it became a bad thing. So the national politics shifted, and tailing it was this production line for engines that we needed to launch, amongst other things, spy satellites to watch the Russians. So, and don't think they didn't notice and say, hey, listen, we can cut the supply off of this stuff if you keep, you know, harping on us about, you know, Crimea or whatever the topic of the day was going to be. They would always have that to hold over your head. So cooperation one year is a liability the next, and or, you know, it's always changing. On the private side, you see that the same thing would probably happen. I don't think the national borders and the national priorities end at the Karman line. I think all that stuff extends into space, and that's only going to get worse or more of a reality. I think it's going to be more carved up. I think there'll be room for free flags, like in shipping. You know, Luxembourg is going to be a spacefaring nation. You can get licensed through Luxembourg and do your space flight activities. And that's, you know, nominally a nation. It's really just a place to do banking. Now it's going to be a place you can register your cargo ships. It can be a place you can register your cargo spaceships. Stuff like that will start springing up where government will only be a thin veneer on whatever your space industry is going to do, just to make sure you can vend whatever you're doing in space back on Earth, if that's your model. So I don't see it getting better. I don't see any kumbaya coming. I don't see the United Federation of Planets happening anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I see anti-satellite weapons and unmanned space planes that the military operates. I just see that growing.
That's quite a downer. But no, but on that point, since you brought it up, the idea of the Enterprise, the United Federation of Planets, you know, those of us who grew up on Star Trek always envisioned that space exploration would be, again, this sort of international, intergovernmental type body doing it. Do you believe that first, you know, spaceship to Mars is going to have Elon Musk's face emblazoned on it? I mean, do you think he or someone like him will do it rather than an international or national government organization?
I think he'll be savvy enough to fly an American flag a little bit higher than the SpaceX flag, but they'll be on the mast together, and I don't think they'll have very much control over it. I think that'll be to preserve business interests at home. I see the government following the industry on this one. I don't see any government agency controlling what's going on here once it becomes a compelling interest to ignore it. Money over paper is one of my mantras, and as well, and national security as well over paper. So if there's a piece of paper stopping a lunar mining colony from turning over, you know, a $23 billion haul, ain't nothing stopping that. So I think the industry, if one forms, will probably win out. And I think the geographic distance, historically, has always given you, as the explorer, colonist, trailblazing person, that's when you can make, you get the most latitude. Once you've proven it out and they try to reassert control, that's when you have your colonial, you know, civil wars and your wars of revolution and that kind of thing. So economically or physically. So it's part of that continuum, and it's not part of the, you know, James T. Kirk standing on the multicultural bridge necessarily. I think it's probably more like a boardroom. It's probably more like Alien, where there's corporations who are zipping around and are playing it, can play it a little fast and loose and set their own rules.
Wow, and, we're getting cheerier.
Joe, you can't see our faces, but I would describe us as both having grimaced as you were likening this to Alien.
The future is here, and it's scary. We've spoken mostly in terms of the billionaires in space, which I need to repeat as often as possible, about Elon Musk. I mean, Jeff Bezos, I mean, Blue Origin for a while took a much, much lower profile approach to things. Can you talk about how does that differ from sort of Elon Musk's goals? I mean, they're not talking about, like, you know, traveling to Mars quite yet.
Yeah, it's not lofty. It's really, if I was an investor, I'd probably want to invest in Blue Origin because it's innovative and it's daring, but it's not
bluster.
It doesn't feel irresponsible. It doesn't feel so forward. I mean, they have a lot in common, their secret, you know, Texas rocket test sites and their devotion to Cape Canaveral as a hub of launching, and they're going after similar markets in satellite launch, but he's taking a different approach. He kept literally under the radar until he crashed a spaceship, which I go through that in the book. It's a funny moment where this small town in Texas didn't even know what this guy was doing, you know, on this ranch land outside of town, until he crashed a rocket ship outside of the confines of the test area, and they had to respond to it. They didn't even know what chemicals were in there, and the firefighters show up. So, you know, talk about a low profile, isn't even telling the neighbors about that. And he's since fixed that. He's been very good with the neighbors since then, but he recognized it as a soft spot. But as a contrast to Elon Musk, who took all of us aerospace journalists on a tour of the SpaceX launch pad the day before the end of the shuttle program. So, I mean, he was always very media forward, and that where I thought that was a liability, it's really worked. Now, Jeff Bezos is digging deeper roots. He's got, rocket manufacturing facility being built in the Cape, and he's getting involved in satellite programs that are more, you know, aimed literally and figuratively at helping Earth. So he sort of has that approach down that a little bit better than Musk does. He's not as freewheeling, and he's slower, but it's deeper, and it seems more stable. Then again, he hasn't launched anything into space. He hasn't launched anything in the National Space Station. He doesn't have a contract to launch people. But he's doing all of that quietly. So, you know, if that makes him a dark horse candidate, because he's intentionally keeping what he's doing in the dark. But he's laying down roots, and he's going to have a big 2018, especially towards the end of the year, when some of the things that he's working on, he reveals them. Even in late December, he tested out in West Texas a manned castle in some flights. So who knows what the guy is going to actually reveal. He's really good at keeping secrets, and it's part of his business model. So it's fun to have another one in the wings, another billionaire in the wings, to unveil something interesting besides, you know, Paul Allen and Burt Rutan and Elon Musk. So there's it's good to have him in the mix, and I think what he's doing could be, and alliances that he's forming with traditional space, it's going to help them reform, drive their prices down, not be reliant on the Russians. And he's a solution to a lot of problems that the more stagnant traditional space launch industry suffers from. And I think he's finding a lot of, you know, receptive ears in those boardrooms, and he's cutting good deals with them. So he's definitely in the mix. He's doing it differently than the other guys.
Now, of course, you focus mostly on people who are actually launching things. Emily, you also profiled a couple people who aren't quite launching their own rockets per se, but certainly have futuristic visions. There's Yuri Milner. Talk a little bit, Emily, about his idea and what he's funding.
Yeah, so Yuri Milner is funding the research and design for Breakthrough Starshot Initiative, which is about getting to Alpha Centauri. So, is quite sort of futuristic, even more so than Mars or the Moon, and which, you know, when you read about it, everybody's sort of like, okay, yeah, that's far out, that's futuristic, but wouldn't it be so cool if we could manage to do it? And by all accounts, so the people who you know, work for him or work with him sort of differentiate him from the Bezos, from the Musk, from Branson's, by saying, you know, he's really, he just grew up as an astronaut, and this was his first love, and he wanted to go into it, and he couldn't, and now he has this money, and he's invested it, he's great to work with, and blah blah blah. But there are also people who are quite hesitant and say, you know, he invested this money, but what happens when those millions run out, and we're still not at Alpha Centauri, and then what happens to this very expensive program?
So there's no business plan. It's not a
right. No, this
commercial.
Is a truly, it is. It's not. a commercial plan. It's not a commercially viable plan. It's truly a plan about scientific inquiry and curiosity, which makes me, as just a private citizen, sort of nervous about, you know, should we be having a few very rich individuals dictating which way scientific inquiry goes? I spoke to the head of one astronomy department who reassured me that academics and scientists cannot be so easily swayed, which I believe, having, you know, spent some time with professors, but sort of can't believe because they also have to follow the money.
So now back to my favorite topic, the nation of Asgardia.
Yeah, Asgardia.
Who's behind that and why? I don't even know how that fits into the others.
It's so different from the others. This is a gentleman by the name of Ashrabiuli who eventually wants to get people on the moon and have pensioners and arcs in space. But for so if you are an aging person, just get ready. You can go with Mr. Ashrabiuli on an arc in space. But for right now, he has what he calls the first space nation. And originally it was sort of, you know, it was just like a website and people could fill out a form and apply to be citizens. And he was sort of the first citizen. And then recently they launched a satellite into space that had people's private data on it, so you could have, you know, I guess illicit photos if you wanted. You could also have your cat videos, and they would be there in space. And he said the whole idea here was to, you know, citizens' personal information was out there beyond the boundaries of nations and geopolitics. But what
porn in space? You're basically saying porn in space.
There's porn in space, and it's not dictated by you know geopolitics. But what I thought was so interesting is that if you read the fine print, it actually is governed by European, like, intellectual law. So I think this is a really nice symbol of how even if you go to space with your money, you, like, the Earth and its tentacles and its realities will come and find you, and you can either create responsible regulations to make sure that that is appropriately done, or you can send a satellite with porn into space and sort of hope that nobody realizes that you're still governed by the laws of Austria.
Red tape is everywhere. Okay, one last question, Joe. So if you're a betting man, who makes it to Mars first, NASA or Elon Musk or someone else?
Boy, I'm not much of a betting man. I would probably bet on Elon Musk at this point. Yeah, betting on NASA is never a good idea. So that in that way, it's easy.
Double or nothing. What year?
Oh, 2027.
Huh. Okay.
For a manned mission, maybe a little bit later, but somewhere around 2027, 28, probably. Faster than we thought, but shorter than anyone expects, and it won't be a colony. It'll be a visit, or maybe it'll be to bury Elon or something. Make a tomb for him on Mars or something like that.
On that note, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. Emily, thanks too. You can check out Joe's new book, Space Poor Earth. And ER listeners, again, thanks for joining us. We like to hear from you. So if you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Thank you. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.